This is the tax update for June the 23rd, 2008. This week, the proposed pay-prepare penalty regulations the IRS released this week. The Tax Update podcast intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio podcast. Such a prohibited use includes using the podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, this week, one of the joys of doing continuing education lecturing came to me, as on Tuesday morning as I got up, I was presented with, by CCH, 200 pages of proposed regulations on Section 6694 on the very day I was to lecture on tax practice standards, penalties, and all those other neat things in front of the Arizona Society of CPAs for a full-day, 8-hour course. Needless to say, I had an interesting morning with my breakfast and reading regulations at the same time, and I discovered that the timing, I was certainly wishing at that point that the IRS had waited one more day to do this release, but the issues are out now. We now have the proposed regulations. This week in the podcast, we're going to take a look at those proposed regulations and perhaps explain the way it appears the IRS is going in terms of coming up with final regulations. The IRS's expectation was that they would have final regulations in this area out by the end of this year. And according to the preamble to these regulations will take effect no earlier than after December 31st, 2008. It would seem very likely that if they do go into place before the end of this year, that in fact the effective date will be January 1st, 2009. So at least tentatively, we need to be prepared that some of the items discussed here will go into effect on January 1st of next year and be ready to understand how that might impact our practices. Now, these particular proposed regulations have been long awaited. We've known they were coming from last May when the IRS and when the Congress gave us the changes to Section 6694. Those changes, as you may recall, increased the penalties that are applicable to preparers for returns with positions that do not meet the 6694 standard, and more importantly, raised that standard from realistic possibility without disclosure to more likely than not if a position is not disclosed on a return, and for disclosed positions raised us from frivolous, it had to be merely not frivolous, to a requirement that there be a reasonable possibility that the position would be sustained on examination. That is, there's a reasonable basis, I should say, for the amount to be, there's a reasonable basis for the position that's presented. That the raising of those standards was significant because at the first end for disclosure, preparers had a disclosure level that triggered earlier than taxpayers did in order to get out of any penalties on the taxpayers' end. And on the lower end, not frivolous was an extraordinarily low position. Now we're looking at having to have a reasonable basis for a position. Reasonable basis indicates that we're going to have at least some sort of support for the position, something we can point to in the source documents is going to say why that position has any more than a merely colorable argument that it might be the proper position. Now, the regulations they issued affect more than just 6694. The IRS took this opportunity to make changes and review the other prepare penalty related provisions. The IRS indicated in the preamble to the regulations they intend to have these regulations finalized by the end of 2008, with the regulation to be effective for filings sometime after the final regulations are published, but in no event before December 31st, 2008. Until that time, we are under the guidance that we got in Notice 2008-13 at the beginning of this year, as modified by Notice 2008-46. And as noted, that guidance is going to apply at least through the end of this year. So again, for the rest of the 2007 filing season and for any other return filed before the end of 2008, you look at Notice 2008-13. As well, the IRS indicated there is more to come with regard to the story of preparer penalties. As noted in the preamble, the IRS said the Treasury Department and the IRS believe that the recent amendments to the tax return preparer penalty provisions necessitate a comprehensive review and overhaul of all the tax return preparer penalties and related regulatory provisions. These proposed regulations are the first significant step in this process. Now, we're going to consider mainly the 6694 changes in these discussions. Note, the IRS did make changes to other provisions and other penalties. Specifically, they made changes in what qualifies for due diligence on the earned income credit. We had changes in signing returns issues, changes with regards to giving copies of returns to clients, various other rules that are impacted by these. To a large extent, many of these changes are simply applying the rules to non-income tax returns that previously applied to income tax returns with no significant changes. But the IRS simply decided that now is the time to step back and get all of this back together at once. Now, the one key issue that we get to here initially is that the IRS adopts us for the dates that rules for the data return is prepared. Under the proposed regulations, consistent with what we found in Notice 2008-14, we have for purposes of penalties under Section 6694, a return or claim for refund is deemed prepared on the date it is signed by the tax return preparer. Well, that's pretty easy. I sign the return on March 10th. March 10th is the date it is deemed was prepared for the purposes of these penalties. If a signing preparer fails to sign the return, then it's determined to be prepared on the date the return actually is filed with the IRS. So if the client holds on to that return for a month and then files it, that month later date is the date filed. Why is that important? Because eventually under the regulations we discover the date at which the more likely than not position has to exist or the date at which reasonable basis has to exist is that date that we just talked about, that trigger date. And obviously if the client holds on to it for a month, situations may have changed. Therefore, significant incentive to make sure the return got signed by the preparer. In the case of a non-signing tax return preparer, and yes, there are such things, if you haven't been following along, that's always been true. The relevant date is the date the non-signing tax return preparer provides the tax advice with respect to the position giving rise to the understatement. The date will be determined based on all facts and circumstances. Now note the difference in treatment here for signing versus non-signing preparers. A signing preparer gets the date the return is signed. That is the date, essentially, the return is completed. If the return is not signed, we get the date filed. For a non-signing preparer, and that includes advisors that are brought in solely to give advice, who never actually do compliance work on any return, never prepare a single return, the date the advice is given is going to control. That means it's going to be extremely important that the preparers in these cases have adequate records to back up their position or to prove the date on which the advice was given. As we'll note, in many cases under these regulations, the internal records of the firm doing tax return preparation or tax return advice work is going to become extremely important in order to determine either who's subject to the penalty, if the penalty is going to be relevant at this time, whether it does or doesn't apply where these tax return preparation issues. And we need to make sure that we check over carefully what we have in our records and procedures. Now, one major change in the proposed regulations is the replacement of the one preparer per firm standard with a one preparer per position standard on the return for returns who have signing preparers. Previously, the signing preparer was, for the firm that that person worked for, the person subject to penalty under the Internal Revenue Code. That was true even if that person had relied upon positions from others within the firm. And those others within the firm, had they been located in another firm, would have been non-signing preparers and potentially subject to penalties for the items in which they were involved in. In this case, the signing preparer was at a disadvantage when the advice came from inside the firm. Conversely, non-signing preparers were in better shape if they gave advice inside the firm. So it's six of one, half dozen of the other there. Now we're going to have a different situation that's going to simply state each position on the return will stand alone. And each position on the return will have or potentially have a preparer who is subject to penalty the one preparer per position. We determine who the preparer is for that position, and that preparer is going to be the one subject to penalty on that position. In the preamble to the proposed regulations, the IRS explains a rationale for making the change. The IRS notes, the Treasury Department and the IRS believe that the amendments to Section 6694 made by the 2007 Act, together with evolution in existing business practices, I suppose you could read that to mean consolidation of firms and different professions inside the same firm, and the increasing complexity of federal tax law that has created an increased need for specialization, require reconsideration of the one preparer per firm rule. Specifically, the Treasury Department and the IRS believe this evolution requires adoption of a framework that centers on the return or claim for refund on a position-by-position basis, with the focus of any penalty on the positions giving rise to the understatement on the return or claim for refund and any responsible parties with respect to such positions. Thus, the Treasury Department and the IRS believe the one preparer per firm rule is no longer appropriate and have proposed to adopt a framework defining a preparer per position within a firm. Now, you find the preparer per position standard in proposed regulation 1.6694-1B1. It provides, in general, for purposes of this section, tax return preparer means any person who is a tax return preparer within the meaning of Section 7701A36 and Regulation Section 301.7701.15 of this chapter. Well, note, we're going to discuss that last regulation because that's a crucial item as we get to the end of this presentation about who is a preparer. An individual is a tax return preparer subject to 6694. The individual is primarily responsible for the position or positions on the return or claim for refund, giving rise to an understatement. There is only one individual within a firm who is primarily responsible for each position on the return or claim for refund, giving rise to an understatement. In the course of identifying the individual who is primarily responsible for the position, the Internal Revenue Service may advise multiple individuals within the firm that it may be concluded that they are the individual within the firm who is primarily responsible. In some circumstances, there may be more than one tax return preparer who is primarily responsible for the positions, giving rise to an understatement if multiple tax return preparers are employed by or associated with different firms. Now note the way that works. Inside the same firm, one preparer is going to be subject to the penalty. If we have multiple firms that are all involved with this position on the return, we may find penalties providing us one preparer in each of the firms that were involved in the position. For instance, we have a transaction reported on a tax return. Both a law firm, outside law firm the client retained that gave advice on the matter after the transaction took place, and the CPA firm preparing the tax return, both are involved. In theory, preparers from both entities could be penalized. As well, both entities can be penalized. Of special interest in this regulation is notes that the IRS retains the option of essentially casting a wide net and telling a whole bunch of individuals within the firm that they might be the ones subject to penalty under 6694, and then being able to come back in later and throw out anybody who, you know, turns out not to be covered by the penalty. This suggests that the IRS may treat this much like a penalty for failure to deposit payroll taxes, where they find multiple people who may be responsible per parties and simply assess against everyone and let them duke it out. They will each turn evidence against the other. One key issue under these regulations, there's a lot of cases where individuals within the same firm may have an incentive to essentially turn on each other if the penalty is going to be assessed as we work out who gets hit with it. Now, those in larger firms with a number of specialists are most affected by the change from the one preparer per firm rule that we had for the firm with the signing preparer. Previously, non-signing specialists could hide behind the signing preparer, but now they are exposed to penalties. Anyone in the firm who becomes a tax return preparer, and that may be almost everyone in the firm of any professional standing, is fairly easily can become a preparer in that regard, anybody except somebody doing merely clerical work. All of those people are potentially exposed and potentially may face this penalty. Now, as we'll discuss, for non-signing preparers, there are a lot of de minimis rules that may make that less likely on most returns for that to be a major problem, but it still is potentially possible for anybody in the firm to get hit with that. no longer is assigning preparer the person who is the only one exposed to the outside world. If you're inside that firm, you're fine. Not true anymore. However, the signing preparer is still the person that faces the greatest scrutiny under the regulations. Regulation 1.6694-1B2 provides the signing preparer within the meaning of Section 301-7701-15B1 of this chapter will generally be considered the person who is primarily responsible for all the positions on the return or claim for refund giving rise to understatement. It may be concluded, however, based upon information received from the signing return preparer or other relevant information from a source other than the signing return preparer, that another person within the signing tax return preparer's same firm was primarily responsible for the position or positions on the return or claim for refund giving rise to understatement. In essence, the initial suspicion is going to fall on the person signing the return if someone in the firm is a signing preparer for the return in question. Evidence may show some other preparers when it should be held responsible, but signing preparers need to be aware that initially they are facing the presumptive exposure for every position embodied on the return. Essentially, well, right now they face exposure for every position on the return, so in one sense, it doesn't change things that drastically. In fact, if anything, at least opens up the possibility they could somehow shift the burden over to somebody else in the same office. Professionals in firms, though, may end up needing to prepare their own personal protective documentation when they take positions on a return in reliance on the advice of another preparer in the firm. And those who give such advice also may need to document that happened to show whether, in fact, they were deeply involved enough to become effectively the preparer for the position in question, and, as we'll discover later, if the advice was given after the transactions in question took place. That is, it dealt with already existing facts, not potentially to be existing facts. Non-signing preparer standards are found in proposed regulations 1.6694-1B3, which provides, if there are one or more individuals in a firm who are non-signing tax return preparers within the meaning of Section 301-7701-15B2 of this chapter, and there is no signing tax return preparer within the meaning of Section 301-7701-15B1 of this chapter for the return or claim for refund within that firm, the individual within the firm with overall supervisory responsibility for the positions giving rise to the understatement is the tax preparer who is primarily responsible for the position for purposes of 6694. Additionally, if after application of paragraph B2 of this section it is concluded the signing tax return preparer is not primarily responsible for the position or the IRS cannot conclude which individual, as between the signing return preparer and other individuals in the firm, is primarily responsible for the position, the individual within the firm with overall supervisory responsibility for positions giving rise to our statement is the tax return preparer who is primarily responsible for the position for purposes of Section 6694. Now, what that all says, very short of it, is within a firm, if the IRS can't tell who is the signing preparer, the director of the firm's tax practice better watch out for it. If you have a firm that doesn't have such a structured existence, and we have a number of partners, and there's not a clear delineation of who's the tax person and who's, let's say, the A&A person, but it seems like everybody does everything, potentially, the IRS has got to pick and choose there to decide who has overall supervisory responsibility and hits them with a penalty if they can't tell any better. What that does mean is if you are the director of tax practice for the firm in question, or you reasonably could be considered to be that person, you may face, if the fighting starts happening inside the building as to who's responsible, at the end, you may be the one facing sanction by the IRS if it is determined a 6694 penalty should be applied. As I say, none of this is really meant to breed a bunch of goodwill, shall we say, inside the firm once a 6694 penalty starts being discussed. The person with overall supervisory responsibility is not really indicated how we determine that. It's going to be most likely a facts and circumstances case. And that's probably going to be a matter of dispute as well with the IRS and with preparers inside the firm. Now, the IRS does go on to provide three examples to show how to determine who is a preparer in various fact situations. In example one, an attorney provides advice to a client concerning the proper treatment environment with respect to which all events have occurred on the income tax return. Now, that's important because, as we'll discover later, advice given before items have taken place is not going to be tax preparation advice. That's what gets you in trouble. In preparation for providing that advice, A, seeks advice regarding the proper treatment of the item from another attorney, who is B, who is within the same firm as A, the original attorney. But A is the attorney who signs C's returns tax form preparer. B, attorney B, the non-signing attorney, provides advice on treatment of the item upon which A relies. B's advice is reflected on C's income tax return, but no disclosure was made in accordance with 1.6694-2C3. The advice constitutes preparation of a substantial portion of the return within the meaning of 301.7701-15B3, and the IRS later challenges the position taken on the return, giving rise to the understatement of liability of tax. For purposes of the regulation under 6694, A, the signing attorney, is initially considered tax return preparer with respect to C's return, and the IRS advises that signing preparer that the signing preparer may be subject to penalty under 6694 with respect to C's return. Based upon information received from the signing attorney or another source, it may be concluded that B, the other non-signing attorney, had primary responsibility for a position taken on the return that gave rise to an understatement because that attorney had overall supervisory responsibility for the position giving rise to an understatement. Again, if A, the signing person, can convince the IRS that B, the non-signing, really had the primary responsibility for this position, attorney A, the signing preparer, gets out of the penalty, and B now faces the IRS's scrutiny. Now, in example two, they say take the facts we just went over, except neither the first attorney, who is the signing attorney, nor any other attorney within that firm signed C's return as the client's return as a tax return preparer. Attorney B, who was the one who actually gave the advice and worked on the matter, is a non-signing tax return preparer within the firm with overall supervisory responsibility for the position, giving rise to an understatement. Accordingly, B is the tax return preparer, is primarily responsible for a position on C's return, giving rise to an understatement, and is subject to penalty under 6694. In the third example, again we have assumed the same facts as the other two, except attorney D, who works for a different firm than attorney A, also provides advice on the same position upon which A relies. It may be concluded that D is also primarily responsible for the position on the return. Note the issue there, also primarily responsible. Also and primarily responsible seems to be a contradictory set of terms, but nevertheless it means a couple of them may get hit. One factor to remember when reading these regulations is in order to be subject to a penalty, one must be a preparer. As we'll discover later, these proposed regulations contain a revised definition of just who is a preparer, and existence of certain de minimis exceptions may eliminate the issue for a significant number of individuals that would otherwise be non-signed preparers. This also is one of the areas the IRS in the preamble notes may very well be subject to change. They're asking for comments on this whole area of determining who could be subject to the penalty of the signing and non-signing preparer rules in this area. The IRS has continued the general rule that preparers may reasonably rely on information provided to them by the taxpayer or a third party, reassuring some preparers who last year began panicking when the new rule, when the new law came down in 6694, they now had to go out and verify every single item ever shown on the client's tax return. In essence, we can still continue to do, under proposed regulation 1.6694-1E1, to rely on items given to us and information given to us by the client and other third parties, as long as that reliance is reasonable, and we consider all information that we are aware of in concluding that we're going to rely on that information. We don't have to go out and search for contrary information, but if we're aware of contrary information or anything about that, about the information we are given, is one that a reasonable person should have concluded. It's reasonable to expect that a competent practitioner would have suggested that's not reliable information. You can't just bury your head in the sand and rely upon it. We cannot ignore the implications of information that we know or become aware of. That's very similar to the rules that CPAs face in the compilation arena over when we deal with the test engagements that are compilation engagements. We don't have to look for and attempt to obtain information to support the assertions that management makes on the financial statements. But if we know those assertions are in error, or we have strong reason to believe they are in error, we can't ignore the implications of what we know. Now, the IRS gives a number of examples here to illustrate how this would work. In the first example, during the interview that we conduct, the taxpayer stated he had made charitable contributions of real estate in the amount of $50,000 during the year, when in fact he'd never made the contribution. But he said, I gave $50,000 to real estate. We don't inquire about the existence of a qualified appraisal, which would be required for a $50,000 donation of real estate, nor do we complete a Form 8283 non-charitable cash contribution in accordance with the reporting and substantiation requirements under Section 170F11. We do, however, report the deduction on the tax return for charitable contribution. That results in an understatement of liability for tax, and we sign the return as the tax return preparer. If we do that, we are subject to penalty under Section 6694. In the second example, while preparing the 2008 tax return for an individual taxpayer, we realized the taxpayer did not provide a Form 99 for a bank account that produced significant taxable income in 2008. We inquired about any other income the taxpayer furnished Form 1099-F for use in preparation of the 2008 tax return. We were not aware the taxpayer owned an additional bank account that generated taxable income for 2008, and the taxpayer did not reveal this information to the tax return preparer, notwithstanding our general inquiry about any other income. We asked, you know, is this all the income you had? The taxpayer simply says, oh yeah, that's everything I've got, never informs us about that other bank account. We signed the tax returns, the taxpayer's returns tax preparer. We're not subject to a penalty under 6694. It would appear to me the point of this example is to emphasize you don't get yourself in more trouble by following up on information the client gave us. When it turns out there's some other area that had you followed up there, you would have found out about this if you had no reason to know about that second area. You're not going to get yourself in trouble by doing more work. So you don't have to just say, I'm only going off the client's organizer. That's all I'm going to do, because if I do anything else, I'm effectively, quote, auditing the return, unquote, is a term I hear people use from time to time, which I always think is an extraordinarily dangerous thing for anybody who is a CPA to ever use that word in any way except the exact way we know it is used professionally in the professional literature. But simply because we've gone out and done verification work on an area that we thought had a problem, that does not mean suddenly we're open up to penalty because we didn't go out and verify everything on the return for those areas where there was no obvious reason to verify it. In essence, if we have to find undisclosed bank accounts, that's a little tough. You know, do I have to go out and ask the client about every single bank that exists in the United States and perhaps overseas to try to find out if they had any information from those accounts? Probably not, and I certainly don't have to send and get back confirmations from those banks that they each don't have an account for this client, for this taxpayer. In example three, in preparing a tax return, the accountant G relies on the advice of an actuary concerning the limit on deductibility for a plan contribution. On the basis of that advice, we complete and sign the tax return. It's later determined that there is an understatement of liability from tax that resulted from the incorrect advice provided by the actuary. The actuary gave us a bigger deduction than was actually allowed. We had no reason to believe the advice was incorrect or incomplete, and the advice appeared reasonable on its face. The actuary didn't tell us that for a one-person company where the guy made $10,000 and is age 22, that we could put back $20 million into a defined benefit pension plan. That's probably unreasonable on its face. We also were not aware at the time the return was prepared of any reason why the actuary who was consulted did not know all the relevant facts or that the advice was no longer reliable to developments in the law since the time the advice was given. The accountant here, which would be us, is not subject to a penalty under 6694. The actuary, however, may be subject to a penalty under 6694 if the advice given by the actuary constitutes substantial portion of the tax return within the meaning of Section 301.7701-15B3 of this chapter. In fact, I would say quite often the actuary may find that they're going to be the person who is the preparer for purposes of a plan contribution on the return. Most accountants do not, nor would they be expected to have the expertise to determine the proper amount of deduction in the case of something like a defined benefit pension plan. We may know enough to know something that smells like it shouldn't fly, but we don't know enough to know that the specific number the actuary gave us is fine. Only the actuary can provide that support. So actuaries may find themselves subject to penalty under these standards. Again, that's not really a major change because they were non-signing preparers effectively before, but just a reminder, Actuaries can be non-signing preparers, and they could be subject to the 6694 rules for the assessment of penalties against signing preparers, or against not signing, but all preparers. Now, what about the income derived? Because remember, the penalties under 6694A and B both are determined by reference of 50% of the fees derived from the bad advice, shall we say. It's subject to the minimum amounts for each penalty. That is, the penalty could be no less than $1,000 under 6694A, which is sort of the one where we didn't disclose properly, but we weren't going willfully against a regulation, etc., or $5,000 for 6694B. That's the more willful or reckless violation provision. The issue of how to calculate the income derived from the engagement becomes important, and the regulations deal with that matter, dealing with both the firm's fee and that of individuals who are employees of the firm. It should become apparent that in this arena, like many others in these regulations we'll look at, documentation by the preparer and the preparer's firm is going to become crucial to limit the potential amount of the penalty. This penalty applies both to individual preparers and firms who prepare tax return. The question of how to calculate individuals' income derived from that engagement poses an initial problem. In theory, all of the staff accountants in my firm may be subject to penalty under 6694 as well as the firm. For non-equity holder employees, those who are not partners in my firm, in the situation of a preparer, we find 1.6694-1F1 tells us how we apply penalties against them. In the situation of that preparer who is not compensated directly by the taxpayer, but rather by a firm that employs a preparer or with whom the preparer is associated, income derived or to be derived means all compensation the tax return preparer receives from the firm that can be reasonably allocated to the engagement of preparing the return claim for refund or providing tax advice, including research and consultation, with respect to the position taken on the return or claim for refund that gave rise to the understatement. Now, given the $1,000 minimum for a 6694A penalty, in most cases, the amount of salary allocable to the specific engagement for a non-equity holding employee will be less than $2,000, making the $1,000 the true penalty the individual would face, or $5,000 in the case of a willful violation. However, if you're an equity holder of the firm, things get worse fast. Proposed regulations 1.6694-1F1 continues. In a situation where a firm that employs the individual tax return preparer or a firm of which the tax return preparer is a partner, member, shareholder, or other equity holder is subject to a penalty under 6694A or B pursuant to provisions in 1.6694-2A2 or 1.6694-3A2, income derived or to be derived means all compensation the firm receives or expects to receive with respect to the engagement of preparing the return or claim for refund or providing tax advice, including research and consultation, with respect to the position or positions taken on the return or claim for refund that gave rise to the understatement. The proposed regulation goes on to note that if there are multiple engagements involved related to the same return or position, these engagements are aggregated for computing the fees noted above. And that's true for employees, equity holders, and the firm itself. An important limitation on computing the proper amount of fees allocable is found in this portion of proposed regulations. The preamble notes that proposed regulations also provide that only compensation for time spent on tax advice that is given with respect to the events that have occurred at the time the advice is rendered and that relates to the position giving rise to understatement will be taken into account for purposes of calculating a 6694 penalty. This rule is intended to be consistent with the definition of tax return preparer in Section 301.7701-15b2. Implementation of this provision is found in Proposed Regulations 1.6694-1F2II. As the penalty relates to return preparation, work done before the transaction takes place does not count for these purposes. That wasn't to prepare the return, because until the transaction takes place, there's nothing to report on the return. Rather, that's the pre-transaction planning advice. Once the transaction's a done deal, now it's a done deal, and at this point forward, the rules kind of come to conclusion. Now the issue becomes how to report it on a compliance basis. It's now a compliance issue. We need our records to clearly delineate a couple of things. First, we need to have clear records of when time was incurred and when time was expended on the engagement in question. Because in many cases, we may not break this down between pre- and post-transaction. It may all get billed as one group. but we do need to have clear records about when time was incurred. Secondly, we have to clearly document and have in our files what was the date on which the transaction took place. At that date, we swap over to being preparers, and the advice and work from that point forward is potentially subject to the penalty, or at least to bring our fees in for the penalty. Now, since for most significant transactions, we hope the client's going to consult with us prior to pulling the trigger on the transaction, most of the research and advice would take place prior to consummation of the deal. And this could very significantly reduce the calculation of fees involved. Now, don't forget, we still face the minimum $1,000 or $5,000, regardless of how little time ends up in the end being allocated. And as noted, as the above notes, a person who only consults prior to transaction taking place is not going to be deemed to be a tax return preparer when we get to that definition. The proposed regulations allow that the total fee may be less than the total amount billed on what the firm saw as the engagement in question. That is, a lump sum fee will be allocated to limit the calculation to the amount related to the position that gave rise to our statement of tax. But it's up to the firm or preparer to have documentation to allow for such an allocation. Proposed regulation section 1.6694-1F2IV provides, for purposes of paragraph F1 of this section, it may be concluded based upon the information provided by the tax return preparer or the tax return preparer's firm, note who provides the information, that the appropriate allocation of compensation attributable to the position giving rise to the understatement on the return of claim for refund is less than the total amount of compensation associated with the engagement. For example, the number of hours of engagement spent on the positions giving rise to the understatement may be less than the total hours associated with the engagement. If this is concluded, the amount of the penalty will be calculated based upon the compensation attributable to the positions giving rise to the understatement. Otherwise, this is the bad side if your records aren't good enough to establish that fact, the total amount of compensation from the engagement will be the amount of income derived for purposes of calculating the penalty under Section 6694. Our time records become extraordinarily important at this point to help determine how to allocate things and to keep track of what is related to this position versus what is not. If you and your staff are used to just coding everything into broad categories, that may come back to haunt you if there's a significant transaction which is challenged on the return. If we can't tell for sure how much of the time involved in the preparation of the return related to the suspect positions or how much of the time involved in the engagement actually related to the return, we may find out we're subject to a much higher penalty than we had to have been subject to. If both the individual preparer and the firm are held liable for the penalty, and yes, they both can be held liable, the combined penalty will be limited to 50% of the amount derived by the firm, with the individual's penalty capped at 50% of the amount that individual's compensation. And remember that for equity holders, that's going to essentially be identical to the firm's amount outstanding. Note that this does provide some incentive for the firm to attempt to sacrifice an employee preparer. It becomes clear the firm's going to be subject to a penalty. Intra-firm finger-pointing is likely going to be an uncomfortable side effect of many of these rules if they go into effect when a firm faces a 6694 challenge. Now, the IRS gave us more examples to apply these provisions. In the first example, the signing tax return preparer H is engaged by a taxpayer and paid a total of $21,000. Of this amount, $20,000 relates to research and consultation regarding a transaction that is later reported on a return, and $1,000 for the activities related to preparation return. Based on that preparer's hourly rates, reasonable allocation amount of compensation related to the advice rendered prior to the occurrence of the events that are the subject of the advice is $5,000. The remaining compensation of $16,000 is considered to be compensation related to advice rendered after the occurrence of the event that are the subject of the advice and return preparation. Income derived by this preparer with regard to the return for this purpose of computing penalty under Section 6694A is $16,000, and the amount of penalty imposed under Section 6694A is $8,000. Now, again, note, all of this determined what was the taxpayer's, what was the preparer's allocation based upon their records, the records of their hourly rate, the records of what had been done. This suggests, again, we need to be concerned about these matters. Also note the use of hourly rates there. If your firm doesn't bill hourly, does that mean the IRS is going to have some trouble deciding in those cases? And if the IRS gets confused, remember the default is everything subject? don't know what that means. Hopefully there will be commentary on that particular issue, and we'll get a clarification going forward with the IRS about what types of methods are going to work or how they're going to allocate this if there's not an obvious hourly rate involved. Now, three accounts are employed by a firm. One, I is a principal manager of the firm and provides corporate tax advice for the taxpayer after all events have occurred subject to an engagement for corporate tax advice. J, another member, provides international tax advice for the taxpayer after all events have occurred subject to a different transaction and engagement for international tax advice. And K prepares and signs the taxpayer's return under a general tax services engagement. I's advice is a source of understatement on the return. The advice constitutes preparation of a substantial portion of return within the meaning of Section 301.7701-15B of this chapter. He's a non-signing preparer. With the overall supervisory responsibility for position on the taxpayer's return. Thus, I is a tax return preparer who is primarily responsible for position on the return given rise to the understatement. Because K's signature as a signing tax return preparer is on the return, the IRS advises K that K may be subject to 6694A penalty against K to the understatement. K, nice guy that he is, provides information that I, as a tax return preparer, the primary responsibility for position that gave rise to the understatement, and K formed a reasonable belief the position more likely than not be sustained the merits by relying on the advice provided by I. Furthermore, K has reasonable cause because K relied on I for the advice in the corporate tax matter. The IRS therefore assesses a 6694A penalty against that part of I's compensation that is attributable to corporate tax advice. In the event the firm is also held liable under Section 1.6694-2A2, the IRS assesses a 6694A penalty in amount not exceeding 50% of the firm's compensation based on the engagement relating to the corporate tax services provided by I where there is no applicable reduction in compensation pursuant to 1.6694-1F2III. Example 3. The same facts as above, except I provides advice on the corporate tax matters in the event have not yet occurred. I's advice is the cause understatement position on the return, but I is not a tax return preparer. K has reasonable cause because K relied on I for the advice of corporate tax matter, and K is not limited to reliance on persons who provide post-transactional advice as such advice is reasonable in good faith. I, K, and firm L are not liable for the Section 6694 penalty. Note, that is a perfectly reasonable way things can work under these transactions. If the non-signing preparer does all the work before the transaction and the signing preparer relies on the advice given, the pre-transaction advice, then in fact, and that reliance is reasonable, there is no penalty. Now what that makes clear is we'd better have records that in fact the advice I gave actually took place prior to the transaction. I was not the non-signing preparer. In that case, 6694A does not apply. I may have some discussions with the IRS about the covered opinion regs and covered opinion provisions under Circular 230, but that's another discussion for another day. And even if the covered opinion rules don't apply, I may have a little more trouble with just the general written advice rules under Section 10.37 of Circular 230. Now, the preamble notes for firm liability that the proposed regulation would add one additional time when a firm could be held liable for the 6694 penalty as compared with the current regulation. The new provision is found in proposed regulations 1.6694-2A2III with similar language involving 3. The 2 and 3 difference is 2 is the $1,000 penalty, 3 is the $5,000 willful or gross negligence penalty. Now, this is a special rule, and under this point, if we employ a preparer subject to a penalty under 6694A, the firm subject to the penalty if and only if one or more members of principal management of the firm or branch office participate in or knew of the conduct. So if we know one of our employees is acting the way they shouldn't, the firm is liable if one of our principal members knew of it. We failed to provide reasonable and appropriate procedures for the review of the position for which the penalty is imposed. That's also true, and remember, that's an or clause, so either one of those would trigger it, or, this is new, such review procedures were disregarded by the corporation, partnership, or other firm entity through willfulness, recklessness, or gross indifference, including ignoring fact that would lead a person of reasonable prudence and competence to investigate or ascertain, in the formation of the advice or the preparation of the return or claim for refund that included the position for which the penalty is imposed. The IRS has now clarified that disregarding your firm's review procedure through willfulness, recklessness, or gross indifference will expose a firm to penalty. Clearly, firms need to have well-documented procedures to review positions to ensure compliance with these provisions. If the procedure put in a manual that no one actually follows, though, or are disregarded when inconvenient to the engagement because they give us a tax answer we don't like, the firm faces liability. Consideration should be strongly given to the use of tax preparation checklists and other types of tax return review procedures. The AICPA Tax Division provides such checklists to its members each year that includes checklists for a large number of return types. That includes specifically estate and gift tax returns that now are subject to the penalty for the first time. And non-members can purchase the checklist. In fact, even non-CPAs can purchase the checklist, along with other items to use for their practice. Cost of the checklist is around $100. It's about the same cost as membership in the tax division for a member of the AICPA. But obviously, if you're not a CPA, buying the tax division membership is a little bit of an extreme issue. To become a CPA, become an AICPA member, get the tax division membership, you probably just want to buy the access to the checklist from the tax division of the AICPA. Or alternatively, PPC offers similar, more limited set of checklists in their various desk books in their desk book series. In their case, they offer individual checklists. They're not as heavy in the other areas for checklists, but their books do form the basis, perhaps, of at least coming up with such a checklist. We'll talk about now the question of reasonable belief of more likely than not. The more likely than not standard, the reasonable belief position in the revised Section 6694 is what attracted the most attention when Congress passed the provision, and proposed regulations explain how this standard will be defined and applied. Proposed Regulation 6694B starts out describing the general rules for applying the more likely than not test, and it tells us that basically if we reasonably believe it would be sustained on its merits, if we analyze the facts and authorities and reliance, reasonably conclude in good faith that it has a greater than 50% likelihood of being sustained on its merits. We cannot consider the possibility the position will not be challenged by the Internal Revenue Service because the return will not be audited or because the issue will not be raised in audit. Those aren't issues we can take. It pretty much reiterates the prior rules, except it raises the standard to more likely enough and realistic possibility. As well, we continue to cross-reference regulations under 6662 to find out what are our authorities. As I've noted before, the major difference there between what we had under the AICPA standards, statements on standards for tax services, is the AICPA says it is okay to rely upon editorial materials that are well-reasoned. The IRS specifically says that's not going to serve as reliance unless you follow up to the source documents. The regulations, however, do allow for considering a taxpayer's experience and other factors and taking into account this judgment. Whether a preparer meets the standard be determined based upon all facts and circumstances, including the return preparer's diligence. Determining the level of diligence in a particular situation, the preparer's experience with the area of federal tax law, and familiarity with the taxpayer's affairs, as well as the complexity of the issues and facts, will be taken into account. Now, CPAs need to remember that despite the above, under the Code of Professional Conduct, they are required to make the determination they have adequate technical expertise to accept an engagement that they can have or either can obtain that expertise prior to finishing the engagement. So it may be that if you get out from the penalty because we determined you simply didn't have the background to properly understand the issue, that's wonderful. You got a 6694 penalty, but now the state board wants to talk with you. That may not be good. What about new law positions for which authority has not been released? The IRS tells us that in that case, we may reasonably rely upon a well-reasoned construction of the applicable statutory provision. That makes sense if you think about it. Code trumps everything, and if all we have in existence is code, it certainly seems that code should work, and a reasonable interpretation of that code is the test the courts would apply in coming to their conclusion about whether or not the position is one they would sustain. So, frankly, it seems to me the IRS is conceding here nothing that they didn't have to concede with a more likely than not standard if they haven't issued any guidance as of yet. Preparers can also reasonably rely on the work on other preparers and coming to the reasonable belief the position more likely not be sustained. Basically, we can rely on the good faith we can accept if we accept in good faith the position of another tax return preparer that we don't have any reason to believe is in error, then we can be out of the penalty even if it turns out that other preparer was in error. Now, we cannot base our position on unreasonable assumption, either factual or legal, including those that we either know or had reason to know were unreasonable. So if we know this isn't right, or we know the law has changed since such time as that advice was given, we can't just continue to bury our head in the sand and rely on the original advice. We continue to rely upon the same sources we always did in the regs under 6662-4D3III, for attorney positions more likely than not. And while officially administrative practice, that's where the law may literally say result A is required, but the taxing agency has a long-standing practice of not pursuing the issue to that level, the most obvious example has been historically capitalization policies that almost every large company has for assets acquired. There is no actual position in the code that says you can, you know, ignore capitalizing long-lived assets that have values below X dollars. But the fact is, the IRS has for years accepted, as long as they didn't really do anything to distort income, such positions among all kinds of taxpayers. That's administrative practice, though. It is not anything you're going to find that's going to fit one of the authorities in the 6662 regs. Now, the IRS offers a number of examples related to application more likely than not determination. And if you've read the SSTSs for the ICPA and interpretations, some of these may sound familiar. First example, new statute silent as to where the taxpayer may take advantage of certain tax benefits. Treasury and the IRS have not issued any interpretive guidance for newly enacted provision. A well-reasoned construction of statutory text supports the position that the taxpayer may claim the tax benefits. The preparer may avoid the 6694A penalty by taking the position that he reasonably believed the taxpayer's position would more likely than not be sustained on its merits. In the second example, after the passage of legislation containing new statutory provision, a taxpayer engaged in transactions is adversely affected by the new provision. Prior law supported a position favorable to the taxpayer. We believe the new statute is equitable as applied to taxpayer situation. Statutory language, however, is unambiguous as implied transactions deny the result claimed by the taxpayer previously. In considering the new statutory provision as applied taxpayer position, we cannot avoid the 6694A penalty by taking a position that the tax return preparer reasonably believes the position would more likely than not be sustained on its merits. The mere fact we don't like the law change, we think it's unfair, and the prior law clearly allowed us to do what we were doing, does not allow us to continue to take that same position. The third example, while preparing taxpayer's return, we determined that a statute is silent as to whether the taxpayer may claim a certain position on the 2007 income tax return. Three private letter rulings issued to other taxpayers in 2002-2003 support the taxpayer's position. Temporary regulations issued in 2004, however, are clearly contrary to the taxpayer's position. After the issuance of temporary regulations, earlier private letter rulings cease to be authority and are not taken into account determining whether a taxpayer position satisfies the reasonable belief the position would more likely not be sustained in the merit standard. The preparer may not avoid the 6694A penalty by taking the position that the tax return preparer reasonably believes the taxpayer position would more likely not be sustained on its merits. What this points out is the whole point of this game is not just to find something that supports your position and ignore the fact that it's been overturned, regulations have been issued, that it's currently not valid guidance any longer. You can't do that. It's not just a game of finding something to support your position. Rather, you have to look for all levels of authority, both those that support and go against the position in question, and evaluate those authorities in coming to a more likely not conclusion. CPAs, unfortunately, have been found, as I recall a study from a number of years ago, wish I could cite to it at this point, the CPAs were found far more likely than attorneys to essentially want to kind of get their answer they want and then really, really just only put the blinders on when doing research and never find contrary positions. Be certain to actively search for contrary authority. First thing is, if your client's examined, the agent's going to have that authority, so you might as well be aware of it. And secondly, it's about the only way you can really do a service to your client is to give them the true picture of the law. Our job is to let them know what the position is, tell them what their options are, and go from there. It's not just to give them a false sense of hope, telling them everything is wonderful and great, when in fact it's not. And you will be penalized, as this example notes, if you basically ignore the fact that or come to the conclusion, well, here are two private letter rulings that are on my side, and there are temporary regulations that are against me. Ah, that's 2-1. We win. Doesn't work that way. Example 4, in the course of researching whether the interpretation of a phrase in the Internal Revenue Code is a position that is more likely than not to withstand its merits. The preparer discovers that the only relevant authorities include decisions of five U.S. courts of appeal. Three courts of appeal have construed the language as being taxpayer favorable. Two other U.S. courts of appeal, however, have construed the identical language as being favorable to the government's position. The U.S. Court of Appeal in jurisdiction where a taxpayer is located does not address the issue. The preparer reasonably believes the taxpayer's facts more closely parallel facts involved in the three U.S. Courts of Appeal decisions that were taxpayer favorable. Under the analysis prescribed by Section 1.6662-4DE3II, we may avoid the Section 6694A penalty by taking the position the taxpayer preparer reasonably believes that a well-reasoned position consistent with the taxpayer favorable interpretation more likely not be sustained on its merits. The date for determining, now that particular one there, is when we have a split in the circuits, our circuit's not ruled yet. The example doesn't tell us if our circuit has ruled exactly how we'd move forward. Obviously, that's a negative. What's even better, though, is if our circuit has ruled against us, but the circuit that we would go to if we filed in the Court of Claims, the Federal Circuit, has not ruled against the taxpayer, ruled in a taxpayer-friendly manner. Now that's a more interesting construction. In fact, that's a construction where I think you would have the position of arguing more likely than not, largely based on the theory that we could go to Court of Claims, and Court of Claims, the answer is going to be favorable, and so long as we don't believe that that's an outlier decision, essentially, or some reason why that shouldn't work. And note the importance presented here by the fact that we did consider whether our case really is in agreement with the favorable cases. We could probably make a strong argument for more likely than not. Now, what if we won't clear the more likely than not standard? Well, now let's look at reasonable basis, the lower standard. Previously, all we had to do was get past the not frivolous standard. That's pretty low. Now it's been raised to reasonable basis. Proposed Regulation 1.6694-3C2 contains the definition of what constitutes reasonable basis, the new minimum standard even for disclosed positions. That provision provides, for purposes of this section, reasonable basis has the same meaning as in Section 1.6662-3B3 or any successor provision of the accuracy-related penalty regulations. For purposes of determining whether the tax return preparer had a reasonable basis for a position, a tax return preparer may rely on good faith without verification upon information furnished by a taxpayer, advisor, or other tax return preparer, or other party, including another advisor or tax return preparer at the tax return firm, as provided in Section 1.6694-1E. Now, the definition found in Regulation 1.6662-3B, which is what tells us what reasonable basis is, reads as follows. Reasonable basis is a relatively high standard of tax reporting that is significantly higher than not frivolous or not patently improper. And remember, those were the standards we had before. With disclosure, the reasonable basis standard is not satisfied by a return provision that is merely arguable or is merely a colorable claim. If a return position is reasonably based on one or more of the authorities set forth in Section 1.6662-4D3III, taking into account the relevant and persuasiveness of the authorities and subsequent developments, the return position will generally satisfy the reasonable basis standard, even though it may not satisfy the substantial authority standards defined in 1.6662-4D2. Okay. In addition, the reasonable cause and good faith exception in Section 1.6664-4 may provide relief from the penalty for negligence or disregard of the rules, even if return position does not satisfy the reasonable basis standard. Now, a scary aside here is 3I that says in general, just says reserve, so at some point hopefully we'll fill that one in. The relationship to other standards, though, is a useful position here, because here it tells reasonable basis standard is simply higher than not frivolous standard, applicable to preparers under 6694 as defined in Section 1.6694-2C2, or at least what used to be there at that standard. So we have kind of a used-to-be provision in that regard. Once we have determined a position meets the above standard but does not rise to level more likely than not, we need to look at proposed regulations 1.6694-3C3 on how to comply. And the IRS has basically chosen a contained solution brought out in Notice 2008-13. The issue, as we have previously discussed, a taxpayer under 6692 only gained benefits from disclosing positions that failed to meet the substantial authority standard, which is lower than the more likely than not, though not an extremely lower standard. But the difference creates a clear conflict between the interests of the preparer who needs disclosure earlier and the client who is not required to attach a disclosure for positions until they meet the substantial authority level. Now, the IRS solutions are listed in Regulations 1.6694-3CI, beginning with the signing preparer. For the signing preparer, there are basically four ways to get out of this, depending upon your facts. If the position is disclosed with an 8275, 8275R, or in accordance with the annual revenue procedure, if you disclose, no problem, we're fine, if as long as we have a reasonable basis. If the position would not meet the substandard for the taxpayers to avoid a penalty under 66D2B without disclosure, there's no substantial authority, we provide the return that includes that disclosure. Okay, as long as we give them the return, that will be work as well. So in the first case, the return filed actually has a disclosure. In the second case, the return we gave the taxpayer has a disclosure. Taxpayer may yank it off before they file it. Probably not a good idea to tell the taxpayer to yank it off before they file it. That might suggest you really didn't provide it. But you're not going to be held responsible if the taxpayer pulls that off the return, is what B tells us. C, if the position would otherwise meet the standard for non-disclosure under 66D2BI, substantial authority, if we have substantial authority, not more likely than not, if we advise the taxpayer of all the penalty standards applicable under 6662 and we document that advice in our files, we are fine even if no 8275 is attached to the return. We don't put one on the return. None is filed. We're still fine. As well, Section 6662D2B does not apply because the position may be described as a tax shelter reportable transaction with significant purpose of tax avoided or illicit transaction. The tax return preparer advises the taxpayer it needs to be a minimum substantial authority for the position, that the taxpayer must possess a reasonable belief that tax treatment is more likely than not the proper treatment in order to avoid penalty under 6662D or Section 6662A is applicable, and that disclosure will not protect the taxpayer from assessment of the actual slave penalty if either Section 6662D2C or Section 6662CAPA applies the position. Tax return preparer must also contemporary document he provided that advice in the files. And E, for returns or claims that are subject to penalties under penalties, subject to penalties pursuant to Section 6662, other than substantial understatement penalty under Section 6662B2 and D, tax return preparer advises the taxpayer of the penalty standards applicable to the taxpayer 6662. We also must contemporaneously document. That is, we're never put in a position where we have to put a disclosure on a return where the taxpayer would gain no benefit from having made the disclosure. Now, we'll hold at this point, cut this off, go to part two in next, and I'll release the part two podcast here after a little time to give you time to digest this, because we're now running on an hour on this podcast. So we'll give you some time to digest this, and later on this week, I'll release part two of this, which will give us the second half of our discussion. In the materials, we're at page 18. This week I will be presenting at the Prescott Estate Planning Council and the Los Angeles chapter of the California Society of CPAs. I'll be lecturing in both cases, luncheon discussions of the statements on standards for valuation services, just for fun to play with that for a couple of days. So I have those provisions coming up. After that, I have the virtual machine presentation in the middle of July for the Arizona Society of CPAs. If you're down here in Phoenix and want to attend that, it'll be in the morning, actually, session for that one. So it'll be kind of a breakfast session discussing the use of virtual machines. After that, my next on-the-road trip for CPE purposes will be for the Missouri Society of CPAs. As well, I've got presentations coming up in other states later in the year, including Wyoming, Ohio, Idaho, and I've got a week in California coming up in October where we deal with pass-through entities and S-corporations with the California Education Foundation, California Society of CPAs. That particular week, I start in Sacramento, do 2 days there, 1 day in San Francisco, 1 day in Los Angeles, and 1 day in Pasadena, then back to Phoenix. So this has been the tax update for June the 23rd, 2008. The tax update, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to visit them for information of interest to tax practitioners. And be sure to follow up with us here as we go into part two of this later on this week after we've given you some time to digest this part one.